You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. A long drive home might be a time to savor. You might look forward to catching up with your folks. Maybe think about all those people you haven't seen in a while, old friends you want to connect with. For Beth DeWitt, one of the protagonists in Jenny McFarlane's new novel, House of Deep Water, that drive home is dreadful. Let's listen to McFarlane reading from the book.
The house had blurred in her mind over the years. In the darkness, it seems to have grown larger. She knows it's painted pale yellow, but for the life of her, she now has trouble making it out against the sky. There is no moon out tonight. The alley behind her is dark, the street lamp burnt out. She stares at her father's house, trying to discern the pitch of the roof, the stairs leading up to the back door, anything. She should be able to find a happy memory of it. This is the house where she spent her early childhood, the house where they lived when her family was still whole. And yet, even as she strains her mind, all she can come up with are memories of Gilmer Thurber here, in this house, his presence in every corner, filling the house like dark water. The longer she stares, the harder it is to see, so that she finds herself turning away, giving the house the side eye, trying to trick it into materializing. Next to her, Dan snores quietly. Jeanette shifts in her sleep and gives an unhappy whimper. Beth knows the house stands there, yet the lot seems to be full of stars in space, with distant planets dotting the wall facing her. The Milky Way is folded into the roof. Her eyes are sore and dry. She finds herself dozing, her head drooping onto her chest, and then her eyes blink open. She could close them, just for a second, if only her mind would quiet. Instead, she stares at the house until its eastern-facing wall grows pale, until the sky around blues and brightens. At first, she thinks it's a trick of the light, but as the dawn comes on stronger, the house turns blue and stays blue. It's been painted recently, she realizes. It's only the third week in September, and the mulberry tree in the backyard is a sunny yellow, its leaves dropping onto the grass beneath. A light goes on inside the kitchen, and she can see her father, Ernest DeWitt, through the gauzy curtains, poking around in the fridge, the pantry, making coffee. At the sink, he pauses, tilts his head, then reaches out and pushes the curtains aside. "Wake up," Beth says quietly, and when Dan stirs next to her, she adds, "We're here." She has to tell herself, "Get out of the car, go inside the house." She shakes her head. Dan wakes his sister, and Jeanette comes briefly to life in that moment when her body is awake before her brain has booted up. "It's morning," Jeanette says. "I slept in a car all night." She seems proud of this fact, like it's the kind of bohemian lifestyle she's always longed for. Even as her kids open doors and stretch in the new sun, even as Beth's father greets his grandchildren for the first time since they were little, Beth has to keep telling herself, "Get out of the car." Jeanette walks right up to Ernest DeWitt and hugs him, and something inside Beth stirs violently. She spills out of the driver's seat and onto the driveway. "Eliza," her father says, and just hearing her childhood name makes her bowels turn to ice. He has his arms held open to her. She doesn't want to forgive him so easily. She doesn't want to hug him, doesn't want to be here, yet here she is, standing dumb and tired in the driveway as the smile he wears grows strained around the eyes. His face sags at the jowls, his glasses are crooked on his nose, and she finds herself staring at him. She'd forgotten the details of his face, and she wonders briefly whether he really is her father. They look nothing alike, and not just because he's white. The round, upturned nose, too small for his face, and the fleshy jaw. His arms, those strong, tan arms, go heavy, they droop, and Beth inserts herself into them to prop them up. "It's good to see you," he says, and kisses her forehead. "When did you get in? I was waiting, but I fell asleep on the couch." "You painted the house," is all Beth can say. "It was Linda's idea," he says, and turns as the back door claps shut. There, standing on the stoop, is a girl Beth recognizes immediately. Dirty blonde hair, a little too much makeup smudged from sleep. Linda Williams. When she was in high school, Beth used to babysit the Williams girls. Linda would have been about 10, old enough to stay home alone, really, except her mother seemed keen to foist the girls off on anyone else. Beth wonders what her father is doing with this child, but it occurs to her that, creepy as it is, the relationship makes a kind of sense. There's something of the child in Ernest's gaze, something that feels like a game of hide and seek. When you look into his eyes, you might catch a glimpse of a shoe or pigtail disappearing around a corner, but when you follow it, it's gone. Speaking with Ernest, it's easy to lose all track of the present. You're so focused on seeking out the child hiding. Beth has always hated this about her father. She has only ever wanted him to grow up. A bit of a hypocrisy, really, given that she too has a child inside her, that she had felt the child stirring, shifting in sleep when her father called her Eliza. Her anger at her father is in part anger at her own inner child, whom Beth can't seem to shake. "So nice to see you again," Linda says, sidling up next to Ernest, inserting herself between father and daughter. Beth remembers Linda as a horse girl who always smelled like hay and manure. Now her hair is unusually full and glossy. Her fingernails are too long for a farm girl's. None of this is to be overlooked. Even so, Linda stands with her hands on her belly, still flat like a 20-something's. Beth notes Linda's rosy cheeks, her pudgy face. Beth closes her eyes. Her father has put a child in this child.
Beth DeWitt is one of several characters having a hard time coming to terms with small-town life. McFarlane, who lives in Chelsea, weaves her characters into a tense ensemble piece set in a fictional Michigan town on the western side of the state. There are family dramas, hidden trauma, betrayal, and collision after collision among people who know each other's soft targets. House of Deep Water was published in late March. Jenny McFarlane joins us today. Jenny, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
Jenny, you were born in Grand Rapids. So I'd like to begin with the question that I'm sure every writer who produces a tangled family drama loves to answer. Will you tell me about where you grew up?
So I lived in Wyoming, the outskirts of Grand Rapids, until I was 11. And then we moved to Constantine, which is a farm village that might look a bit like Riverbend, although I assure you Riverbend is a fictionalized, it's a town in and of itself. It's different.
Right. What was it about small town life and your experience of it that you wanted most to catch?
It's really complicated. There's definitely a closeness and a community in small town life that I missed when I was living elsewhere. But there's also, there are ways in which I never felt like I fit in the town where I grew up. And not just because I was one of the few people of color, I was also into the arts and, sports were the thing to be into. I really loved school, which was not cool, but yeah, there's just a kind of community mindset, I guess, that I didn't fit into. And I wanted to capture that feeling.
Part of what gives the novel depth is the deep emotional empathy that you build up for several key characters in the story. There are traditionally sympathetic characters in this, like Beth DeWitt, who we just heard from. She's returning to her hometown with a couple of sort of surly teenagers in tow. And this young woman, Linda Williams, who's tumbled into a December-May relationship with Beth's dad. But also Linda's mom, Paula, who's been on the run and out of state, sort of escaping her own messy past. She's a character who's committed one of the most cardinal maternal sins, I guess, in literature, having walked away from her children when they were still pretty small. Why did it matter to make readers feel for the, characters who are less admirable?
I mean, I think that especially in Paula's case, she left, but and that is like a major cardinal sin for a mother. But I think that not all women are maternal. Not all women are supposed to be mothers. And I don't know. I just wanted to capture the other side of these stories that you don't often see.
I was fascinated with another character that you built into the story with empathy, a guy named Steve, who has an affair with one of the main characters. And this is the kind of person who just can't seem to stay out of marital trouble. Mm-hmm. And you really turned him inside out so we could see what makes him tick. He's someone who manipulates women into relationships, but you also show that he wants very badly to understand them. Like in his head, he's never going to have an interesting job. He's never going to be a great parent or a great friend in life. But by God, he's going to have these adventures exploring women's inner lives. It was I wasn't sure if he's not the most key character in the book, but I just understood a little bit more about the women in his life because of the way he thinks about them.
Yeah, he was a difficult character to write for me. I patterned some of his family and some of his actions after somebody that I knew, and it wasn't somebody that I wanted to get to know or give the benefit of the doubt to. So I really struggled on his character, but I think that in the end, like, even the unlikable or the, I guess, kind of anti-hero type characters are real people too, right? So we need to look past the surface and see what makes them tick.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jenny McFarland. She has a new novel called The House of Deep Water, set in Western Michigan. The book includes some really frank takes on what it's like being someone who feels like she's on the outside of a small Midwestern town. It's not the source of Beth's trauma and rage exactly, but it's clear she's been deeply scarred as, you know, as you say, one of the few biracial people in Riverbend her whole life. How central was her experience to the story that was working its way out of you as you were writing this novel?
In early drafts, I think I really skirted around her character and her traumas. I think I wasn't quite ready to address them yet, but it really is the meat of this novel. I think that Beth is just, she's really struggling and she's hurting, and these are things that I have experienced. So yeah, she is the central character.
Not everybody in this book has the same problem, but in their problems, they all kind of meet at a similar crossroads. It seems like the question that each of them is asking themselves is, do I really have what it takes to pull myself out of this emotional mess that I'm in? Do you think most people do have that within them?
I think they do. I think that I'm a big proponent of therapy. I think that if you're a person who's alive in this planet, that you could benefit from therapy. I think that it would help a lot of people to bring out that inner strength to move past those hard points in your life. But yeah, I think everybody has it in them.
I treasure the fact that the book club kit for this novel includes a recipe for Frito pie. Although I have to say I was a little bummed not to see any iceberg lettuce in your particular varietal.
Oh.
Do you want to talk about your essential, what's included in your essential recipe?
Yeah, so I've actually never made Frito pie exactly.
What?
Sorry, we were a tuna noodle casserole kind of family, not Frito pie. But we would make chili and put like Fritos and cheese, which is the essence of Frito pie. But yeah, no, we never put lettuce on there.
Was Frito pie sort of a part of your younger life? And you just felt this needed to be there to sort of ground readers who may not have the Michigan experience?
Yeah, no, food is super important to me. I used to be a chef, so I wanted a lot of good food in there.
Yeah. We should mention you moved back to Michigan not too long ago after several years living in several different states.
I did, yeah. I moved back just in time for winter.
Way to go. Are you finding things very much as you left them?
Sure. So when I left, I was living in Ann Arbor. I'm in Chelsea now, which is a small town. And honestly, it's been a blessing during this COVID-19 situation.
Yeah.
Just because some space to like go out in the world without encountering other people. So I'm really, I think I'm benefiting a lot from small town life right now.
Yeah, I'm sure things look differently at different stages of life, too.
Yes, yeah.
I'd like to get back for a minute to Beth, one of the central characters in the book. Beth is a woman who's on the verge of an explosion, partly because she just has a really messy personal life. She's running away from a bad marriage, and she's, you know, just trying to figure out what the heck her relationship is with her dad. But she's also dealing with sexual abuse that she suffered as a child. And this is something that also you've talked about, the fact that this was something that happened to you as a kid. Beth has not spoken a word of this to anyone ever. Did you learn anything as you were writing through her story about the relative costs of keeping those stories bottled up versus what it costs to tell them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the moment towards the end of the book where Jeanette has this moment and she kind of is like, oh, I see what happened. Jeanette is her daughter. She's 12 going on 30. And I think it really just opens things up for it. Like it opens Beth up in a way that she hasn't been before. It's like a relief to her to be able to see that someone can know this about her and not hate her for it. Because there's a way in which victims, especially victims who have been told to be quiet, feel guilty about what happened to them. And it's not logical. It's not their fault. We know this logically, but there's like this primitive part of your brain that doesn't fully grasp that. And so, yeah, to like unbottle that silence is the most freeing thing in the world.
This story feels a little like an inversion of a chosen family. There are a lot of characters in the book who get thrown together without a lot of regard for, whether they have something to offer each other or whether they're a good fit for each other. There are bad marriages and friendships that have gone sour. There are old relatives who get sick and people who get pregnant. I mean, just life is happening all over the place in this book. I was wondering which has been more important to you, your chosen family or the people you kind of ended up with in the life lottery?
I think they're both equally important, but for different reasons. The people that I ended up with in the life lottery, they're the people who have been with me from the beginning. They understand things that other people can never understand. But my chosen family is also where I draw a lot of my strength from, and a lot of comfort. So I think they're both super important to me.
I sometimes think that each book changes writers in a little different way as they're tackling the challenges of the story. This is your first novel, but I was curious how, if House of Deep Water made a different kind of writer out of you, and if so, how?
Yeah, I'm not really sure how, but I definitely like I look back at there's an early draft of this that is bound as my master's thesis, and it's a very different book. It's in a lot of ways it's shallower. I think this book has maybe taught me to dive into the hard topics, even if they feel insurmountable. And I'm trying to be a braver writer as I start my second novel.
Do you think this book helped you get there?
Yeah, I think it did. I think this book helped me to address a lot of things that I had been silent about for much of my life, and to see that people can read this and know this about me and accept it. And yeah, I think so.
Jenny McFarland is the author of the new novel House of Deep Water, which is available now. You might also want to check out her short story, Growth, in Crack the Spine. Jenny, we're so glad we had you on the show today. And hey, the weather's getting better. You hang in there.
Thank you, you too.